Hello, hello, y'all. We are here for a solo episode, and this has been a long-awaited episode all about PDA. I'm going to break down for you today what PDA is, and yeah, we're going to chat through some support strategies, but we could be here for hours. So I want this to be an intro and a primer. I'm going to totally admit, y'all, like I have been promising this episode, and a little behind the scenes, my private practice is absolutely booming in the best way possible. I am actually, hopefully right after recording this, going to go put a job ad live to hire a psychologist, but I'm super picky. This psychologist has to be willing to embrace neurodivergent affirming practices or neurodiversity affirming practices. This psychologist has to have knowledge of autism and be able to practice in the areas that I am. So it's going to be a really unique candidate, whether it's someone who already is doing this type of work or at least an openness and a willingness to learn. And especially, I think, on this PDA front, because PDA is probably my biggest referral right now in my practice. So if you didn't know this, I can practice. I believe we're up to 40 states. I do diagnostic evaluations for autism. Considering the PDA profile, we're going to talk more about that today, as well as in group therapy, the large majority of parents that are participating in the group therapy program, they're all parents of autistic children, but most, if not all, have this PDA profile. But this episode has been long awaited. I get questions constantly of, do you have a podcast episode about this? I have been promising this, that it was going to be a mini series. I am still working. I think in one of the recent episodes, I talked about developing a course. I'm working on these things and, you know, balancing all of the things, being a full-time clinician, a CEO, and also a content creator. So it's coming in different forms, but just bear with me. Thank you so, so much. I love being able to do this podcast and give you guys free information.
Welcome to a parenting space actually designed for you, where you can get answers about navigating a life that includes autism. I'm Dr. Tay, a licensed child psychologist and parental coach specializing in neurodivergent affirming care. I have supported hundreds of autistic children and their families and have been in the autism field for over a decade. And I know firsthand the impact autism can have. I was 12 years old when my little brother was diagnosed and my family had to learn how to navigate the autism journey. It wasn't always easy. 2 decades later, I now create resources and services I wish my family had, including this podcast, and I developed the whole family approach. On this podcast, of course, we will talk about autism, but we will also talk about your personal growth and well-being as a parent, supporting your non-autistic children, and sharing personal stories of other families so you know you're not alone. Quick disclaimer before we jump into today's episode. Anything shared on this podcast should not be considered clinical advice, and you should consult with your team of medical, mental health, and developmental providers if you need support.
So we're going to dive in today to what PDA is and give you this understanding, this basis, and some support strategies. But just know I have also some guests coming on the podcast who are talking more about PDA too in future weeks. So first off, let's start with some disclaimers, because I think this topic needs disclaimers more than probably most things I talk about on this podcast. What are those disclaimers? Okay, so first and foremost, what PDA is and what we know about it and who it applies to, right? So what PDA is, it stands for pathological demand avoidance. And so it is a nervous system disability. It's when your autistic child's body goes into fight or flight mode in response to everyday demands or a perceived loss of autonomy. The autistic community largely has this conceptualization and has shifted the acronym to either persistent or pervasive drive for autonomy. But it's interesting, I've seen other members of the autistic community who actually don't love the name persistent or pervasive drive for autonomy. They prefer pathological demand avoidance. And some of the argument against pathological demand avoidance is that, number one, the word pathological is in there. Number two, that it's not just solely about demands, rather whether it's this loss of autonomy versus the people that disagree with the persistent or pervasive drive for autonomy feel like that doesn't always explain the nature. And this is exactly the thing. I want to give this like big warning. We don't know, right? So a large majority of our reports on PDA are from the lived experience. And that is super valuable, super important. And I know personally, like it's helped me shift my perspective in my practice so much. It's helped me understand quote unquote behaviors in a different light. It's also as a result, just given me more empathy as a clinician for what some of these kids are navigating, what your kid might be navigating. And so there right now is limited research. There is some research on PDA, but it's limited. So PDA came up as a topic many years ago. It's much more recognized in the UK than it is in the United States, where I'm based out of, but it's been around for some time. And I want to talk a little bit about the controversy of PDA, because I think this informed consent is important to keep in mind. I'm a huge proponent of informed consent. If you go back and or you've listened to my episode on ABA, that's one of the biggest things I talk about is you need to be in the know so that you can make an informed decision of what's best for your child. And the informed consent here is really understanding that should you choose to buy into this conceptualization, that you ultimately understand what the limitations of it is, but then you also recognize it could be beneficial in helping your family to approach things in more of a affirming way. So we have two sides. We have the pro PDA side and the critical PDA side. And y'all, I'm not going to go into all the details, but I got thrown into this conversation very full force because of some of the things that I was posting about PDA, but it became this huge conversation that I got thrown into full force. So it made me really learn about the critical side at a much more rapid pace. However, what I've learned about the critical side, and yes, this episode is on PDA and I'm talking about the critical side of PDA. Again, informed consent is the name of the game here. And also I want to caveat that with that being said, this is described as a very real lived experience. And so this isn't also by talking about this, by breaking it down, I'm not saying that the lived experience isn't real, but again, I just want you to have this perspective. So the critical PDA side, what they say is there's not enough research. There's also concern about subtyping of autism, which I should do a separate episode on this idea of subtyping of autism. There's a lot of conversations around this right now. So previously in DSM-4, which came before the current version, we had three categories. We had PDD-NOS, which you've heard me talk about. If you've listened to my episodes, that was what my brother was diagnosed with way back when. Stands for pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified. We had Asperger's, and then we have autistic disorder, right? Those were the three categories. What research found is that they weren't clearly distinct from one another, and there was so much overlap, and it wasn't consistently diagnosed, right? And I would see this all the time, that sometimes clinicians would worry about the stigma with autistic disorder, so they'd give PDD-NOS. Sometimes kids with high IQs would be diagnosed with Asperger's, even though Asperger said there had to be not have been a language delay. And some of these kids had language delays. It was messy. So they collapsed it into autism spectrum disorder. But there's a lot of conversation now about pulling it back apart. And again, I can't go into all of that here, or we're going to be here for forever. Where I stand on this is I hear some of the frustration in terms of varying support needs. And we see that high support needs community talk about what we call profound autism, all of that. And again, I like keep getting tempted to go into this, but I'm going to pull back a little bit of what we know from research is that there aren't these subtypes, and that having this autism spectrum disorder criteria And having this umbrella term really seems to be right now what's serving things best. And so what the critical PDA side is a little nervous about is then, is this just going to become a subtype of autism? Also, the critical PDA side says, but is this better described by other co-occurring conditions, anxiety, OCD, trauma, depression, ADHD, all these different areas? And I'm going to respond in a second to them. So that's some of the sentiment of the critical PDA side. My understanding from the critical PDA side, though, is they're not trying to say this isn't experienced as a real thing. They're just saying we need more information, right? Pro PDA side, let's talk about this, is saying there are so many people with this lived experience and it is very much a real thing. And let me tell you, working with parents, I hear, and this is one of the reasons I lean into this so much, of, oh my gosh, you finally get my kid. So it is this lived experience. It feels like that it ultimately seems distinct in some ways, and that what they find is that traditional behavioral approaches actually not only don't work, but they often activate the child or make the quote unquote behaviors worse. And so that is some of it. And so what the pro PDA side says is this gives us a roadmap for being able to support the autistic child. Now, there's a little bit of confusion, controversy, I don't know the right word here, of is it only under the autism umbrella? And that's where it's so nuanced, where we don't know, right? Right now, we conceptualize it as a theorized, meaning we have a theory about it, and we're leaning into that theory, but we don't necessarily have the data to support it yet, other than the lived experience, which we know in terms of neurodiversity affirming practices is incredibly important, but a theorized profile of autism. Now, what I would say, here's some of my thoughts and my middle ground in all of this. So I literally, and some of you might be like, this is really annoying, but as a clinician, I literally lay in the middle of these two perspectives. I believe that it can be very validating for parents. I believe that approaching from a neurodiversity perspective, affirming perspective, can be very helpful. And a lot of times that these kids have gone through traditional behavioral therapy and the parents have said it's very invalidating. So that's true. I also believe that we need more research. I also believe right now it's under the autism umbrella and not related to things like other types of neurodivergence, meaning it's not a profile of ADHD, for example. I think more often than not, when we think it's a profile of ADHD, what I've seen from my experience so far, and again, this is a limited sample size, I'm not conducting a research trial here, which is ultimately what's needed, is that usually it's accompanied by a high masking autism. Not always, but in these kids that we think, oh, autism isn't part of it. So a lot of the families that come to me for diagnostic evaluations have previously been told, no, it's not autism. Parents then find PDA and are like, oh my gosh, this explains my kid. And then we end up diagnosing the autism. So it's this middle ground of, I think it's an and, right? We can agree more research is needed and the lived experience is very real. We can agree that it is only based on theory and we can choose to support. So I think that's where I stand and how I approach all of this. And I'm careful in how I talk about it too. I will tell you my candid thoughts. And again, I keep saying another episode, but maybe in a future episode, we can get more into this. I don't think our quote unquote problems in the autism field are going to be solved by subtyping. I really don't. I think we're going to have the same exact thing. If we subtype, then there's going to be arguments within each of those subtypes and where you fall and all of that. And I think we focus more on understanding autism as a whole. All the kids I work with, even if they have high masking traits or are low support needs, the diagnostic criteria of autism still is fitting. And so I see some people that are critical of the DSM saying, oh, the DSM criteria doesn't work for certain quote unquote subpopulations, like these high masking individuals, like females. And what I will say is I think we're using it too rigidly. So again, another podcast topic, but let's keep diving into PDA. So I definitely come from this in the very, very middle ground. So what this looks like in function is that if families are presenting to me, I will diagnose autism pending they meet DSM-5 criteria. And then in my reports, I will talk about it being a theorized profile of autism and how the nervous system goes into fight or flight in response to, again, that demand or perceived loss of autonomy. These kids often want things like, let's go through this. They have a hard time hearing no. And it's funny, sometimes I post reels and parents will chime in and be like, oh, my kid would never resist when I say no, or would never say no to me. They're never going to resist. They'll give in eventually. What I hear from these parents of PDA autistic kids is that it's a whole nother level, right? It's literally this terrified fight or flight mode. There is no logic in this, right? So it's a feeling of needing to be in charge. We sometimes will see that the child almost thinks that they're an adult or that they're on an equal playing field as the adults. There's a natural social hierarchy in our society where parents are above children or adults are above children. They want to, that's called a hierarchy. They want to flatten the hierarchy or even be on top of the hierarchy. We also will see things like avoidance or excuses to get out of doing something. This could be straight up refusal, like school refusal or school avoidance. It also can be getting very creative. Oh, I can't do that. I hurt my elbow, or oh, my legs aren't working, or I forget how to do that. I don't know how to do that. Really exaggerated ways. Or again, it could be just saying no there too. A lot of times we'll see it co-occur with emotion dysregulation. So when kids are in this fight or flight mode, they're emotionally dysregulated. And this can look like oppositional defiant disorder, ODD. I'll get into that in a second. This ODD piece, is PDA really ODD as we talk about this? We'll see meltdowns. We also will see engaging in fantasy and loving role play. It seems to be an escape. So a lot of these kids, not all of them, have really creative imaginations and they escape there as a form of self-regulation. We also, again, not always, in any of this is not always, we'll see high levels of masking as well, needing a lot of co-regulation from the parent, a lot of support to help them down-regulate. And so the parental presence and wanting to be near the parent or that primary co-regulator all the time. And so you might be like, as a parent, like I'm never getting space. They follow me everywhere. It can look like, and actually we'll talk about this too in a second, like separation anxiety disorder. And I think it is. And again, we'll get there. So it also could look like that they prefer you. They have a preferred parent and you're the only one that can do things for them. So not having space. But on the other side of parenting, you might feel like you're constantly walking on eggshells. We also, this goes with the masking, but we a lot of times will see different behaviors in different environments because PDA autistic kids want to comply. They really do. But what happens is I want you to think of it. We all have a bucket inside of us, and PDA autistic kids, or these autistic kids is what I'm going to say, is their bucket fills much more quickly. As demands and come in, it fills quicker and quicker. So it boils over quicker, more quickly as well. And so what this might look like is they hold it together all day at school and then they come home and they're having meltdowns. Sometimes we'll hear about that as like restraint collapse. We also will see that PDA kids, it's called this idea of neuroception, that they're just more sensitive to the external, like environmental cues and triggers and all of that. And they're highly sensitive. And I don't mean that in a like critical way of highly sensitive, but rather their nervous system is highly sensitive, not like That they're just like more sensitive to it, literally on a nervous system. I can't talk today. A nervous system level, we see this sensitivity. And so, I just dropped my phone. So neuroception literally describes how neural circuits distinguish whether situations or people are safe, dangerous, or life-threatening. So we all have some degree of neuroception, but when the nervous system is highly sensitive, it basically thinks a lot of things aren't safe. A lot of things are dangerous. And that's when the fight or flight system kicks in. And that's why we see this fight or flight response into everyday demands. I can't remember if I already said this, but as a parent, you also might feel like you're walking on eggshells quite a lot. And so that's something to be mindful of. And then a lot of times too, PDA autistic kids or autistic children with this theorized profile, they might be able to engage in something like play, but they're going to try to have the lead in that play. I often hear from a lot of these parents of, they can play reciprocally as long as they're in charge. They might boss their peers around or their siblings around, telling them what to do, and then lack the flexibility. And here's some of this describes autistic traits as a whole. And so I will say that's one thing that the critical PDA side says is maybe it's just the autism. What the pro PDA side says, and I see this too, is it seems like there's more of a sensitivity to the nervous system. There's this hypervigilance that comes into it. And then one last trait is there's a strong sense of fairness or being very rule oriented. Again, that falls under autism criteria as well. And again, a lot of this does, but then I'm going to talk in a second about these co-occurring conditions. But sometimes that sense of fairness or those rules only apply to other people. They don't apply to themselves. And so this is a question I get in therapy a lot of like, why does my kid insist everyone else does something, but then they don't follow the rules? And that's because there's that perceived sense of autonomy in all of this. So let's talk about co-occurring conditions with this. So I talked about a lot of this falls under the autism framework, and I think it does. I think it speaks a lot to the inflexibility and the rigidity that we see in that B criteria of autism. So we have the social communication and interaction difficulties or differences, and then we have what we call restricted repetitive behaviors, but that really encompasses a lot of different things, and this like rigidity or lack of inflexibility often comes there. Needing things in certain ways also falls under there as well. Difficulty with change and transition all falls under there too. And it also can fall under some of that A criterion too, of differences in social communication and interaction, of not recognizing the natural social hierarchies that occur societally. And some of me is, yes, that is part of autism. And what I will also say is we live in a very neurotypical world. So regardless of what we call it, we do need to support these kids in navigating how they process through this, especially knowing their nervous systems are more hyperactive and hypervigilant to that. And again, the nervous system is hyperactive, not you can have co-occurring ADHD, but not necessarily they're hyperactive. It's just like easily triggered.
Real quick, just a brief interruption, because I want you to know you don't have to navigate this journey alone. If you're in a place where you have concerns about your child's development, you've been on the search for a therapist that provides evidence-informed neurodivergent affirming care, or you're needing more support as a parent, the whole family approach may be a good fit for you. Autism doesn't just impact your child's life, so you deserve care that works for your child and your whole family. Head to the link in the show notes to schedule a complimentary call where we can chat about your unique circumstances. We can help you decide if Dr. Tay, concierge clinical care, would be a good fit for your family. And if not, we will provide you resources for your next best steps.
Okay, co-occurring diagnoses. So what I will tell you is as a clinician, and again, at the beginning of this podcast, there's always a disclaimer of I'm not giving medical or clinical advice. This is for educational purposes only. These are families when I talk about these examples that I am working with in a clinical capacity. And so I can't say 100% that this will be true for your child, but so far, every single kid that I'm diagnosing as autistic that seems to have this theorized profile of PDA also is meeting diagnostic criteria for a co-occurring anxiety disorder. I am usually diagnosing one of three things, either other specified anxiety disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, or separation anxiety disorder is what I've found so far. Separation anxiety disorder usually seems to be in addition to the, either the generalized or the other specified. Generalized anxiety disorder tends to be a lot of worry, but there are other domains that we have to hit, and I'm not going to break those all down here today. But what sometimes happens is kids don't quite reach that threshold of generalized anxiety disorder or have as per, we can't tune into what is happening on a regular basis to know what their worry thoughts are. Also, what I find is sometimes that the anxiety is very diffuse. There's lots of different anxiety in different areas, and that's where an other specified anxiety disorder comes into play. Now, I don't always diagnose an anxiety disorder with autism if anxiety is part of the picture, because anxiety can also be part of that autistic presentation that, for example, worrying about things changing. That fits under the diagnostic criteria of autism. But what I find is there's usually enough clinically significant anxiety above and beyond autism. And then I also but I've had a few cases where I'm also diagnosing separation anxiety disorder. These are the kids that like literally cannot separate from the parent who they need as a co-regulator. A lot of times this is when school avoidance is coming into play or school refusal. There's a lot of sleep difficulties, all of that. So this is, again, I know I talked about at the beginning of this episode, the critical versus pro-PDA side. In many ways, I am pro-PDA because I am supporting parents through this journey, but I don't disagree necessarily with the critical side of it that, hey, maybe this is just a co-occurring condition along with autism. And I'm diagnosing that mindfully. I'm choosing to, because without fail, what happens for these families if they choose not to keep working with me in terms of therapy? And even if they do, this is still true, they're going to go to different medical providers and different therapists, and those providers may not understand PDA. What I find is by conceptualizing it as an anxiety disorder or falling under the anxiety framework, that providers get it at least a little bit more, that they realize that this just isn't autism, that it's autism plus anxiety. I also think that when we think about this fight or flight mode, that ultimately, like, that is anxiety by nature. It also can fall under the lens of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. The complicated thing with PTSD is it has a really high bar, and you also have to have criterion A trauma. What that means is that there are certain things that are described as traumatic. And while there might be a traumatic response, a lot of these kids don't meet criteria for PTSD because the trauma in which they experience wouldn't fit under that criterion A. So often, sometimes in the trauma world, we talk about it as big T trauma, which fits the criterion A of PTSD, and little t trauma. Now, this is not saying that it's experienced as little, quote unquote, trauma, but that's just how it's differentiated. And so a lot of these things that these autistic kids are experiencing would fall under this little t trauma. There are other specified trauma disorders. I often find it's pretty accurately captured right now in the kids I'm working with as under anxiety, but that's not to say that these kids haven't gone through traumatic experiences and won't continue to go through traumatic experiences. So something important to keep in mind. So trauma versus anxiety, maybe even some OCD lens with this fight or flight arousal that's happening. Other co-occurring things that have come into play, and this is then the last piece that I want to get into about the controversy before we wrap up the episode and I talk a little bit about the support strategies. Again, this could be forever long if I went into every single thing I could think of, but is this ODD, oppositional defiant disorder? So before I go there, I want to give you a background and a lens that I also think is really, really important. Is that what we know about ODD, okay? ODD, by definition, is just a list of behaviors. It doesn't always get into kind of the underlying nature of why these behaviors are happening. It is important to keep in mind, though, that a lot of times anxiety, especially in young kids, can present behaviorally, meaning it ultimately looks like ODD, but when we go underneath the hood, so to speak, we see that it's actually anxiety driving it. So that's one thing. ODD also has gotten this stigma in the mental health community, and it also comes with strict behavioral approaches. And because of that, it has complicated the landscape, I believe, of this autism ODD profile, right? And I think that it's often viewed in a way, in some of the way the diagnostic criteria is written in the name, as intentionally oppositional or intentionally defiant. And what I find for these PDA, so to speak, kiddos, these autistic kiddos that have this anxiety, this fight or flight response, is that it's not done in this intentional way. It's done because they're emotionally dysregulated and their nervous system can't handle it. And so that's a lot of times why I don't diagnose ODD. I don't think behavioral approaches are going to be the way to go. A strict behavioral paradigm. A lot of parents say that further activates their child because basically the child views it as invalidating. I get that, right? But the other piece is, I don't think necessarily that PDA is just ODD. I think it's more complex than just being ODD because of this whole fight or flight response into all of this. And this anxiety-driven response is, so I really view it more as in the framework of anxiety versus ODD. As a clinician navigating all of this, first and foremost, in anything I do, I'm talking about the limitations of this. I think that's important. But I also think I realized as a clinician that if I was going to go here, that I had to navigate this. It's not like there isn't DSM-5 criteria. And I should have said that right from the outset of this episode, and I'm realizing I failed now, but hear me loud and clear. PDA is not a distinct diagnosis. And that's what some of the critical side says as well. It's not, right? And so all we can talk about it is being a theorized profile. And like I said, I often, or so far always, have diagnosed co-occurring anxiety disorders. But this is an evolving field. As we learn more, as research is being done, all of that, I might listen back to this podcast episode 2 years from now and be like, I completely disagree with myself. And I think that as a clinician, this is again where informed consent comes in. I educate parents on this, just like I'm educating you on this right now. So I don't really view it as ODD. And some of that is because I steer away from that ODD diagnosis with autism. Some clinicians don't believe ODD is even real. I don't think that is true, but I think it's nuanced and complicated when we're thinking about autism. And I actually steered away from ODD well before I learned about PDA, because some of my research background when I was in academia was about emotion dysregulation and how commonly emotion dysregulation co-occurs with autism. So much so that one of the mentors that I worked with, she was trying to get what's called a specifier in the DSM-5. And it will be interesting to see when DSM-6 comes out, the headway on this, but a specifier that says with or without emotion dysregulation. There's lots of specifiers in the DSM right now. So you can have with or without language impairment, with or without intellectual disability. There's ways to contextualize this autism profile, again, without subtyping. And so what she was trying to build a case for through her program of research is to get this with or without emotion dysregulation specifier, which I think is really interesting to think of, because not all kids with autism, funny, I just said kids with autism there. I think that's my research brain coming out, but not all autistic kids have co-occurring emotion dysregulation, but the large majority do. And I think that there is some overlap between this emotion dysregulation and this PDA profile. So anyway, before all this PDA stuff, I was already navigating away from this ODD because I really was conceptualizing it as part of the autism profile and the co-occurring emotion dysregulation that comes with autism. It's all to say that I don't think ODD usually, I don't think it adds additive value above and beyond, and sometimes can be harmful. And so what the controversy is that I want to talk about with this ODD piece is what we are seeing is that it's largely white individuals that are being identified with this PDA profile and largely white content creators that are speaking about this. And if you've never seen me on social media, although I guess there's a graphic, but I am white and I identify as white. Like I don't have, sometimes someone can look different than maybe what their identity is, but I am 100% white and non-Hispanic as well. And so I recognize that in saying all of this. So what BIPOC are saying is basically, why aren't we seeing BIPOC be identified with this PDA profile as much? And it's problematic. It truly is. And what I will say is we know that there are racial disparities and discrepancies in autism as a whole in terms of who's diagnosed. And we think we're doing better, right? We're becoming more mindful. I think PDA is just magnifying. No, these racial differences absolutely still exist. There is even some argument that PDA ultimately is a whitewash ODD, that we know from research that Black boys in particular are more likely to be diagnosed with ODD than any of their counterparts. And that's problematic, right? For sure. And it's the way in which we view the behavior. And so this idea of whitewash PDA is that, oh, it's a little easier to conceptualize it like that. And that ultimately it's a racial conceptualization that's coming into play. And that shouldn't be the case. So that is some of the controversy of navigating all of this is we are seeing consistency in terms of, you know, white versus BIPOC being identified as having this PDA profile. I think it's super nuanced. I think we know that in the autism field and also the mental health field at large, that there's a lot of ways in which we limit access to care for BIPOC, that their behaviors are interpreted differently, that they aren't believed. And it's not okay. And at the same point, I don't personally believe that PDA is just ODD. I think we need to see more identification in BIPOC, in racialized individuals, and we need to be listening to these BIPOC autistic content creators. And this is as a whole, this is true. If you look on social media, it's a lot of white people talking about autism as well. So then the last piece of this, is it just ADHD? And what we often see with this PDA profile, I tend to see younger kids, so I don't see this quite as much because we can't even think about ADHD being part of the picture until age 4. And sometimes it takes longer for symptoms to unfold, but it's the ADHD profile that often is going hand in hand with PDA. And what we're seeing is a lot of hyperactivity as a way to self-regulate from this nervous system activation. And so it's really complicated and really nuanced, and all of these behaviors are coming together. And this is where I want to tell you a very thorough evaluation can truly serve your child, particularly if you think PDA is part of this. And this is one of the reasons that despite all of this conversation about PDA, again, I got pulled into it. It would have been easy as a response to be like, I'm not going to talk about PDA anymore. But here's why I choose to still talk about it. Number one is that I find PDA sometimes can be a gateway for parents learning about autism. I literally had a consult call today that this child had an evaluation done a while ago and autism was not diagnosed. And I asked the parent, did they evaluate for autism? And the mom even said, I didn't even know much about autism back then. But since this mom has learned about PDA and now can see autism in this new light. Or these are also the kids sometimes that parents are going, is this autism? I don't know. But then when they hear the PDA profile, they know that the PDA profile is associated with autism. It makes them pursue an autism evaluation for their child. And I think this is highly important. Another piece is I really always come at everything from a neurodiversity affirming perspective. And I think that PDA helps us to better understand what some of these affirming approaches are. So I think that's helpful. But the other thing is, I get so many parents that when I talk to them, they're like, oh my gosh, someone finally is hearing me. Someone is finally listening. And these parents for so long feel like the medical community has not believed them about their child, that they're either making it up or that there's absolutely no way that it could be autism and that it's something else. And so these parents finally feel seen and heard. And I think that is a really powerful phenomena as well. All right, before I wrap up this episode, because I know we've been going for a while and there's so many other pieces that and points that I could make to this. So I don't want this to be viewed as this comprehensive perspective. I'm sure there's people that are going to listen to this on both sides, the pro PDA side and being like, Taylor, you're wrong about this, or on the critical PDA side, and they're going to say, Taylor, you're wrong about this. And I am okay. I want this conversation to continue. So this wasn't meant to be this comprehensive overview, but rather an introduction to what PDA is. And also, if your child isn't autistic, let's talk about this real quick. If your child isn't autistic, that's a weird way to frame that. They are autistic. Well, you might not know it yet, but if they're not diagnosed with autism, what I want you to do is consider leaning into a potential evaluation or doing your research of, from this lens, could autism make sense? And what I will do is I have a guide that I put together. I'm going to link that in the show notes for y'all so you can go download it. Lots of places you can find additional ways to keep learning. We're going to keep this conversation going. And actually, I'm super excited about this because I have 3 upcoming episodes. And that's why I needed to get this out and finally do what I said I was going to do. I have 3 episodes coming out where we address PDA in some regard. And there were a couple episodes previously I referenced it. For example, in the episode with Dr. Donna Henderson, it's in the hundreds. I forget. I'm going to try to look real quick. We did briefly define PDA in that, but I wanted something more comprehensive. But 3 upcoming episodes to tune into is first, and these are in no particular order. I have Amanda Diekman from Low Demand Parenting. She's the author of that book. So Low Demand Amanda, we are talking all about the parenting approach and lowering demands, what that looks like, because what we do find for PDA children is lowering demands is often a way to help to regulate them. But I think there's a lot of misconceptions in the field about low demand parenting. So I love to reframe it from this perspective of low demand parenting to high autonomy or high agency parenting. And I actually got that from a fellow colleague of mine, and I loved that reframe. Low demand parenting doesn't mean you drop all demands. Again, it's a perceived loss of autonomy, meaning we can do things. Actually, let's talk about strategies. I know I'm all over the place. Things, and there's more in this guide, but things that are helpful is this low demand parenting, but giving this perceived sense of autonomy. So I love examples like choices, or I love collaborative problem solving by Dr. Ross Green, where you are working together to validate what your child's experiencing and then coming up with solutions that might not be your plan, which is plan A, or plan C is completely dropping your plan, or I often like to think about this as the child's plan or the child's way, but rather meeting in the middle and working through this. So that's a great strategy. The book is called The Explosive Child. Declarative language. So rather than tell, so this is a great example. You're still setting a boundary, but then you're using declarative language. So instead of I need you to get dressed, you could do something like let's get dressed. So it's collaborative and cooperative, but for some PDA autistic kiddos that still activate them. So it might be like, I've set your shirt and pants out on the bed for you. And that's it, right? It's just describing what you've done. And that a lot of times lowers this threat response because they're not directly given a demand, but there's an inherent expectation. I will say this takes a lot of trial and error. I'm not going to say it's easy. This is something I work with families all the time on in group therapy, and it's an iterative process. So it's not a cut and dry, here's exactly what you do. what might activate one kid might not activate another. And so it's important to constantly be trialing things, trying it as an experiment. So lowering demands, giving a perceived sense of autonomy and agency. So that can look like choices. So instead of saying they don't need to get dressed, although let me in a second comment on that, it's going to be like, do you want a red shirt or a blue shirt? You're giving that sense of autonomy, declarative language. But the other thing is, as a parent, I think there's some mindset shifts of letting go of neurotypical parenting norms and of also letting go of some of your internal expectations. So we actually talk about that on the episode with Amanda. Once that's live, you'll need to go listen because it truly was such an amazing conversation. What I talk about, this is something that I learned a lot about PDA, and then I have a framework that I take parents through of thinking through this, but I come back to there do need to be boundaries, right? But it's about choosing the boundaries mindfully. How important are they really to you? What are your family's values? So for some families, this might look like, I don't require my kid to sit at the dinner table each night. They can eat dinner wherever they want. For some of you, you might be going, oh my gosh, that would never happen in my house. Challenge that mindset. Are you saying that because it's a neurotypical standard, or is it a family value for you? And that is the boundary you want to mindfully set. For other families, they don't. That's just something they think they should do, but they don't actually care to do it. So I love incorporating values into all of this, but my non-negotiables I talk about with families, safety is always a non-negotiable, and then key family values. So I'm trying to think of an example of a family I'm working for that. Okay, here's a great example. School, right? Or daycare. So some families will choose to unschool or homeschool as a result because the public school system or any sort of schooling system doesn't seem to be compatible. For some families, it is a value of both parents to be able to work, and the ability to be able to have this kid homeschooled is not feasible. It not only could be a value, it also could be not possible financially, right? So those are things sometimes, but then how can we operate within that system to optimize? So those are some tips and strategies to get you started. But again, low demand Amanda coming on the podcast. I also have Steph Curtis. She talks about navigating PDA. Her daughter is much older and she's from the UK, and the UK is much more in the know about this. So that will be amazing. And then Daniela Boyd, we actually talk about DIR floor time. And while the episode is not specifically about PDA, she does talk about how one of her sons has this PDA profile and how DIR floor time can be a really optimal approach, particularly for young kids. All right, y'all. So that was a lot. I feel like I downloaded as much as I can right now. We need continued conversations. Don't take this and be like, this is the end all be all. What I want you to take from this episode, informed consent and you being in the know was the primary objective of this podcast episode. And in the know about what PDA is and also what our limitations are. It also is to start to give you some ideas of how you might reconceptualize some of your child's behaviors and how you can start to support them in all of this. And for some of you, I think listening to this, it was like, oh my gosh, someone finally gets it. Because maybe for so long you've been told you're crazy or that they're totally fine in school or that this is a parenting problem. I hear that a lot. It's a parenting problem. You can't get your kid to school. No, a lot of times it is not. I can't say always, but a lot of times I find, at least the families I work with, it is not. So that was my hope. It's a primer, it's an intro, but what I want you to know about, this is an ever evolving topic. So again, I might come out with a podcast episode and completely contradict myself later, and that's okay. I think we need to be okay with this growth and evolution and figuring out right now what's the best thing. And I will end with this. I choose to talk about PDA. I choose to educate about PDA. I choose to help parents understand PDA and even put it in my diagnostic reports, because I think that even though we have so much work still to do in this area, and there is a lot we don't know, to me, I'd rather be wrong later on in terms of this conceptualization and in terms of the facts than being wrong later on and invalidating a child's experience, invalidating a family's experience. And so even if you don't buy into this PDA framework, what I will say, I think it encourages you, and I just realized I got off topic and on a tangent, it could encourage you to seek out an autism evaluation, because all of a sudden you can start to see things in a different lens, especially as you keep diving, and you might be like, oh my gosh, my child is autistic, and getting that diagnosis. But it also can start to bring some neurodiversity affirming practices into your home too, or into the school setting. And so I'd rather affirm this experience and use these approaches and be wrong about the facts than vice versa, being confident in the facts and just continuing with this strict behavioral approach, because that is what a lot of our field says to do. And so there's this unknown territory with PDA, but there's also this unknown territory too with neurodiversity affirming care, right? And I just would rather see your child as a human first and what they need. And while there is a lot of misinformation out there, and sometimes that misinformation could be harmful, I think that the large majority of these neurodiversity affirming accounts on social media are trying to say, let's see your child as a human first. Let's validate their experience and let's figure out how we can validate their emotions and their experiences and promote their quality of life. I think as a core, we all agree that this is important and we can be wrong on the facts and we can choose to keep evolving as we have more updated information. All right, y'all, that is a wrap for today's episode. What I thought, as always, was supposed to be short and sweet. I, of course, can talk forever. But what I'm going to encourage you to do, go download the guide in the show notes. I'm also going to encourage you every Monday, pretty much, hopefully this will keep going on. I do an Ask Me Anything. Put your questions there. I also have some highlight bubbles where I've answered a lot about PDA, but let me know what build-offs of this PDA episode we need, right? Keeping in mind that I am working on some more educational content of synthesizing everything I found as a clinician, it was really overwhelming to try to have to piece all of this together. And I know for many parents that having to do all this self-research and education can be a lot. So I am trying to package it that if you do want that kind of next level of support, you're able to get that. But what I will tell you is for the time being, joining group therapy, if that feels feasible for your family and feels aligned with your family, I'm going to also link the information on that below. Could be a great next step for you, but I will keep creating free content too, because this is a value of mine and one of the reasons that I lean into this role of content creator. So let me know what conversations need to keep happening from this. And then I'm going to also encourage you to go back and, or not go back, maybe it's go back when, depending when you listen to it, but subscribe to this podcast because we have some amazing episodes that tap into PDA further coming up. And if this is an old episode and you're catching up, then go back and catch up on those other episodes too. Okay. I think I don't want to wrap this up because it feels like there's so much more to share, but we gotta, right? You got something, you go do you. Subscribe, download, find the resources. I'm here as a continued resource and I will continue to keep it real with y'all. And I'm not afraid to talk about all angles, talk about the controversy, and just know that as I learn more, I will evolve, and I encourage you to do that with me. All right. Bye, y'all.
Before we wrap up this episode, for real this time, I want to share a couple ways you can get even more value and what your next steps could be. First, join the Evolve Facebook group. We do Q&As about the episodes and so much more. I linked that group, my personal social media pages, and any resources I mentioned in this episode in the show notes. So scroll down now and join me online. When you submit questions on any of my pages, your question could be featured on this podcast. How cool is that? I love being able to speak on topics that feel directly relevant to your life. Your questions truly make a difference in the content we create here. One last thing, do your fellow autism parents a favor. Share this episode on your social media and tag me. Autism currently affects 1 in 36 families in the United States and many more worldwide. So I'm sure there is a parent in your social media followers that could be served by this podcast. Thank you again for being here, and I'm so grateful we shared this time together. Bye, y'all.